I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Here's how medical ethicist Dominic Sisti began an op-ed he co-authored a few weeks ago that appeared in the Harrisburg Patriot News. Quote, imagine it's 2 weeks from now and you live in one of the dozens of cities, including Harrisburg, that have recently seen anti-lockdown protests. Your immunocompromised parent or child becomes sick with COVID, so you take them to the hospital because they cannot breathe. How will you feel when you find out that all of the hospital's ventilators are being used by a cluster of individuals, all of whom attended the same protest? It's a provocative question and a timely one, because as the country reopens for business, it's not just protesters who are objecting to wearing masks. There are plenty of Memorial Day photos of beaches and pools crowded with people not wearing masks and not social distancing, much to the consternation of public health officials. We asked Dominic Sisti to join us on Radio Times. He's director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics of Behavioral Care, also an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dominic Sisti, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty.
So what provoked this op-ed?
I just was looking at lots of images of protesters yelling and screaming in the faces of security personnel at state capitals, legislators, and just kind of innocent bystanders. And I started thinking to myself, well, geez, that's really problematic on a number of levels. But then, you know, it sort of struck me that there's, going to be a time and a place when there's going to be an outbreak at one of these protests, and a cluster of folks is going to just swamp a ER or an ICU. And then what happens when, you know, sick people coming in from the community are basically cut out of care because this cluster of protesters now has occupied all of the ventilators and critical care resources that essentially they were protesting in the beginning. So I started thinking about this in terms of fairness and individual responsibility, and that's how, you know, that was sort of the genesis of the piece.
And scarcity as well. You and your co-authors go on to write, protesters who violate basic safety measures should at a minimum sign a pledge expressing their willingness to forego scarce care in the name of their political ideals and to the benefit of their fellow Americans. Any takers on that you know of?
Probably not. I mean, that's more of a rhetorical missive to get some folks to kind of think critically about their behavior and choices. I mean, I think, you know, you say to somebody, okay, you go to the protest, how about you just sign an advance directive that says I will not accept medical care? It might make them pause for a minute, because that is, in fact, the logical consequence, I think, of attending one of these protests is that you may, in fact, get the virus, you may spread the virus, and there should be some consequences to that. I mean, it's essentially a situation of, you know, grave moral hazard, where people are almost, you know, incentivized in a way by politicians and others to take these significant risks without feeling any consequences. So I think it's important that folks know they have some skin in the game, and that's what the point of the paper was.
I've seen pictures of protests, and to be honest with you, some people are wearing masks. They may not be social distancing. A lot of people are not wearing masks. And as we know, we have a right to protest in this country. And I saw a couple of letters in response to your op-ed, and that was one of the points that they were making, which is to say, look, we have a right to protest what we think are as onerous policies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is a fundamental right to protest and assemble. But those rights are not absolute, and I think, the argument that you have a right to protest, therefore you can go around spreading an infectious disease, just sort of smacks of a kind of naive libertarianism. You know, rights are not absolute. There are responsibilities that come with rights, and to, you know, just think, oh, okay, I have tuberculosis, but I'm going to go wander the streets and yell at people. I mean, no one would ever accept that. You'd be put away in quarantine forcibly. So, I mean, I think, you know, rights to assemble, rights to free speech, all these things, they're just not absolute. And I think folks are just missing that point. They think that everything is sort of fair game. But when we're talking about a once-in-a-century pandemic where, importantly, I mean, this is the important point, where asymptomatic people can be serious spreaders, everyone has to be treated as if they're infected. And so, you know, your right to assemble is really going to be limited by the public health situation.
Is there something about the pandemic, this coronavirus pandemic, though, that is unique even as a public health crisis?
Well, I do think that, I mean, it's so new that we have so much, there's so much uncertainty about how it spreads and about who's at risk, that the uncertainty itself makes it, you know, all that more daunting. And we have to be much more, I think, conservative in our public health guidelines to account for that uncertainty. So I think this, you know, this pandemic presents us with a really, you know, sort of novel challenge to understand and quickly come up with ways to mitigate the damage of a, you know, truly novel virus. The fact that it spreads so, you know, pretty much easily, it's sort of aerosolized and small, you know, particles can, you know, travel through the air in closed spaces. Like, that makes it very contagious. And so we've got to be super careful about, you know, congregations and crowds that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have to worry about as much with, say, Ebola, which, as deadly as it is, was harder to spread. So I think this virus has the unique, I think, capability of having a relatively high or relatively high morbidity rate, but also a very, very high contagious potential.
We have heard that message from Dr. Fauci, from other public health officials, not from the White House, I should say. But what is it about that message that you think is so provocative to certain people that they don't want to abide by those directives?
You know, I think a lot of folks have been getting bad information from our leaders, in particular the president. There's been a concerted misinformation campaign being kind of perpetuated and perpetrated by members of right-wing groups. You know, some of these protests have, I think, been organized and funded by right-wing groups that really are not, you know, they're not really protesting the public health measures. It's about other stuff. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think we're in a really weird, you know, political time where there's, you know, two sets of epistemic, you know, viewpoints on the world. And, you know, on the one hand, there's the, you know, sort of public health experts that understand the epidemiology, have studied, you know, epidemiology for, you know, decades. In the case of Dr. Fauci, they're experts. They get it. They understand the basic biology of this situation. And then there's another group that doesn't accept the expertise of folks who spend their lives studying the biology. And I'm not sure why that is, but the fact is, in a case of a global pandemic, you want to, you know, trust in the folks who spent their lives studying virology and infectious disease, and not, you know, your high school friend who tells you it's just like the flu or something.
Hmm. You know, I was thinking of variations of what this op-ed is about, and I'm thinking about secondhand smoke. I mean, if someone wants to smoke in their home and ruin their lungs and maybe get cancer, in certain ways, that's on the end. Unfortunately, when they end up getting medical care, a lot of us have to pick up the tab for that. In fact, that's sort of how insurance works. But we don't allow people to do that in public buildings because of things like secondhand smoke. Is that an analogy that can work for you?
Yes, that's a great analogy. I mean, I think we've all come to get used to the fact that you can't smoke in a restaurant or on an airplane or wherever, because of, you know, the rights of others. And so I think that's a very good analogy. Another analogy might be an individual just decides, I'm going to get drunk one night and drive around. And we would never accept that. It's, you know, you couldn't say, oh, it's my car, my choice, or my body, my choice. Whenever your behaviors, you know, elevate the risk of the folks around you, you need to take, you know, careful account of what you're about to do and be held responsible if you cause harm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm also thinking that medical people and including medical ethicists have to struggle with this issue of compliance. We know that's a problem when it comes to medical care, that people do smoke. They don't eat well necessarily, but we don't deny them treatment.
That's absolutely right. And we shouldn't. And you know, the point of the essay wasn't to say that people should be refused care if they were to, you know, show up at an ER because they were infected at a protest, because that's just not right. I mean, I think that, you know, basic principles of medical ethics demand that clinicians treat everyone equally, notwithstanding political views and all those things. So we don't want doctors making judgments about, you know, who deserves a ventilator based on some political view. But what I would say is that, you know, to be consistent in your belief, you would want to say to yourself, okay, look, I'm going to go take this risk, and, you know, maybe I should let a child in front of me in line, and, you know, because of the risk I've just taken, knowingly. Now, in the case of a protest, that's a little different to me than, mm-hmm. say, somebody who smokes or somebody who's just, like, taking a run without a mask or something, because, you know, those are really premeditated and intentional, I think. I almost think of them as almost like sabotage of our public health system. Like, they're direct attacks on our public health system. And that, to me, is very different than an incidental sort of episode where a person, say, takes a run without a mask, or, you know, forgets to wear a mask out, or touches somebody by, you know, mistake, or hugs somebody because they just really needed a hug. You know, those, to me, are different cases completely. This is what we focused in on the protests precisely because they were so intentional and, you know, sort of premeditated, organized ways of kind of attacking our public health system. I mean, that's what was really troubling.
But what about, I mentioned the you know, Memorial Day holiday celebrations that we saw. These were not protests, but these were clearly people in violation of the kind of public health directives that we all should be abiding by and could have the same kind of consequences that you describe in this op-ed.
Yeah, so we wrote this well before the Memorial Day image.
Yes, I get it. Right.
I didn't thought about that. But, we did start to see things like people on beaches together, which is probably fine. But I think that people are doing things because of, you know, isolation. They want to have fun. They want to see their friends and their family. That's all really understandable. They're making bad choices. I mean, it is the case that they're making bad choices. We all do this. We all make bad, you know, less than ideal choices in life, and we shouldn't be penalized for those choices. The key to me is the intention. If your intention is to actually undermine our public health regime, our public health system, that to me is on a different level than just, you know, needing to meet up with friends and go out to bars. And maybe these folks have a misunderstanding of the, you know, whether it's a, you know, you're in a yellow zone or a green zone or what, they might have they might be making like some essentially innocent mistakes that have them all congregating, you know, and sometimes people obviously choose to hear what the information they want to hear. So it's like, okay, we can congregate now based on some random thing I saw on the internet. But that's different than saying, let's all organize and go down to the state capitol and protest, you know, and this was, by the way, happening at the peak. You know, this was like mid-March, early April, when there were surges happening in Detroit and even still in New York. You know, so I think of those as different situations. I mean, it's true that folks who are in these, you know, I saw an image of a bunch of people in a pool by a barn. First of all, I would not be doing that even if there wasn't a pandemic. That just seems unsanitary. But yeah, that's categorically different to me than a protest.
Sure. Let's hold on to that thought. And again, that's medical ethicist Dominic Sisti. We're talking about an op-ed that got a fair amount of attention. We put it on our Facebook page as well and got a lot of attention as well. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll be right back. I'm Marty Ma.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just do a quick recap. Should anti-lockdown, anti-mask protesters give up their right to medical care if they end up contracting COVID-19? That's the provocative question posed by a group of medical ethicists who suggest that protesters should voluntarily sign waivers foregoing treatment, especially when resources are so scarce. One of those ethicists is our guest, Dominic Sisti. Again, he's director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics of Behavioral Care and assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. We did post that op-ed on our Facebook page, and we got a lot of responses. thoughts. I'm not surprised. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Carol. This is referring to the protesters. They should be the lowest priority for available care. They're making this a political thing. I've seen many unconcerned maskless people in crowded places being interviewed this weekend. Disgusting. A glaring example of the utmost stupidity and lack of concern for others, including their own family members. A comment from Don on Facebook. If you choose to forgo health requirements, you should not accept health benefits. A comment from Jenny, getting steamed up towards the people who are not buying masks and quarantine just feeds into the Trump administration's itchiness to stoke partisan divides and jack up Trump's media ratings. Just curious, Dominic, how you respond to that last comment, which is, it's so interesting that masks, which should be relatively uncumbersome to wear, relatively easy to wear, has become this partisan political issue. The president said yesterday that to a reporter at the White House that wearing a mask was politically correct. How do we get into this situation?
I don't know. I mean, this whole thing is a sort of a journey down a rabbit hole that I never imagined we'd be taking as a society. The idea that wearing a mask is somehow a political statement that's anti-American or something. It's absurd. I mean, you look at images from, you know, the 1918 flu pandemic, everyone was wearing masks. I saw an image with a family, even the cat had a mask on. It was the thing to do. It's normal. It makes sense. It's common sense. And we now live in a society that's apparently led by people who have very little regard for common sense. So, you know, I don't really understand it. I don't get it, but it is a serious public health risk.
Let me get a caller to join our conversation. And this is Harold, and he's calling us from Drexel Hill. Harold, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there. Sure. You're welcome.
Highlighting all the right points. My comments are brief. Number one, the whole thing infuriates me, and I hope someone actually creates those waivers and encourages mm-hmm. people to sign them. But I think there's more going on here. I think this is a reflection of our modern society, which is all about me, me, me. And I think these people are selfish. I guess my analogy would be, he just mentioned the pandemic of 1918, mm-hmm. and a lot of mm-hmm. people have compared this to World War II. Had these people been alive in World War II, I think they would have refused to do the rationing that was being mandated by law, because they were saying, you know, I have the right to have and use and consume whatever I want. And I just, you know, this infuriates me. And I would also just suggest that we create one more zone. There's the red, yellow, and green zone. I think we should create the dumb and careless zone. And okay. at least some of these people that are refusing to do this could wear a T-shirt saying, I'm from the dumb and careless zone.
Harold,
and thanks again to your guests.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Everything you're saying.
You're welcome. Sure. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. But Dominic, I mean, should we call these people dumb and stupid and, you
no.
know,
I
selfish?
No. I get the impulse. And I think there is a level of selfishness or sort of just a narcissistic disregard for the, you know, empathy and lives of others, you know, in some folks. But I think a lot of folks just are, you know, being misled, frankly. And I wouldn't want to demean them. I mean, I think the economic anxieties are real. I mean, I think, you know, that kind of desperation will lead folks, you know, lead you to do all sorts of things that you might not otherwise do during normal times, being stressed about money and losing your job. I get it. My wife is out of work. So, I mean, it's hard, right. But at the same time, it's a call to basically, you know, figure out how we take care of each other and do it well and do it in a way that's, you know, without complaint, you know, not, you can complain about it, but like just take care of each other. And one of the ways to do that is to simply stay in your house or at least keep a safe distance from folks around you and wear a mask. These are two very simple but tried and true ways to not only slow down a pandemic, but potentially end it, you know, in the absence of a vaccine. So I think, yeah, I agree with the comment that, you know, there's a level of selfishness going on here and entitlement. And frankly, you know, a lot of these folks are probably conservative folks who really do value the ideals of individual responsibility, mm-hmm. but they're not really living those values. And that's what this is about. It's about individual responsibility.
I'm also thinking that we're fighting and dealing with this pandemic without adequate information. We don't have enough testing. We don't have contact tracing. And we're trying to address it with so few tools. And I wonder if you think that just feeds people's anxiety and confusion, frankly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Imagine if we had started in January when we could have. And got the PPE supplies in line and had a testing regime that was set up and the tests were reliable and everything was in place. I mean, there was a whole playbook that was at the ready that we could have, you know, initiated in January. And, you know, there was just a Hopkins study I read that showed that if we had started, you know, social distancing a week earlier, we would have saved 36,000 lives. Now imagine if we started that in at the end of January. Mm-hmm. Like other countries did, like other nations who have, you know, competent leadership, frankly, were able to do, we would be on a totally different trajectory right now. We'd be talking about summer camps being open. We might even be talking about maybe a month of school in June. The information, we're essentially in the midst of a, you know, information or misinformation war. And unfortunately, one of the sides of that war happens to be our own, you know, executive branch waging a misinformation campaign. And, you know, it's sort of like our Chernobyl. I don't know if you've ever seen that miniseries, but
frightening.
It really feels a lot like what I felt when I watched Chernobyl. So,
wow.
I don't know what the answer is other than just trying to find reliable news sources, and the CDC would be the place to go, or World Health Organization's website or Johns Hopkins website. Those are places I go every day, and just try to, you know, avoid the noise on social media as much as possible.
I was thinking about you. You mentioned the people that could have been or would have been saved if we had started earlier, and I think it's an important thing to recognize, but it's also a hard thing to understand. It's such an abstraction. The thing that didn't happen is hard to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'm not an expert in the way these models work, but they can create these counterfactual statistical models using the patterns that actually did unfold and just basically retroactively applying them to the past, and that's what they show. And they're, you know, could you ever totally prove that? No, but they're, you know, within the realm of statistical significance.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dominic Sisti. He's director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics of Behavioral Care, also assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about an op-ed he and some other medical ethicists wrote a couple of weeks ago. It appeared originally in the Harrisburg Patriot News, basically saying to people who are protesting the lockdown directives that if you get sick and you have to go to a hospital and go on a ventilator, perhaps you should sign a waiver saying that you would refuse that treatment. Paul called to say in the Declaration of Independence, it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in that order. And he says life comes first. In your op-ed, you quote, and then I guess misquote Patrick Henry, his famous proclamation, give me liberty or give me death. You say not give me liberty. And if that doesn't work out so well, give me a scarce ventilator.
I have to give my colleague, Professor Modi Gorin, credit for that one-liner. I think it does kind of crystallize the view, though, that you really have to walk the walk if you're going to talk the talk about unfettered liberty.
Let me get, it looks like Till, and Till is calling us from South Philadelphia. And Till, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for me on.
Sure.
I am a nurse here in Philadelphia, and I've also worked in other cities with like COVID-19 response. Rapid response, like crisis nurse.
Yeah.
So see a lot of this, of course. And just to be clear, I speak for no hospital or no other medical professional. But interesting, you know, ethical questions, of course, and this should always be part of our practice and what we think about. But just like we tell people all the time, you know, keep your blood sugar under control, don't smoke, don't use heroin, when people do and they get very, very sick or try to die, we aren't going to not give them medical care, right? If there's, you know, an attempted suicide even who shows up at my emergency department, we're not going to be like, well, they forsook their right to medical care, and we're now, you know, not obligated to try to save this life. So, of course, it does complicate things and does, it is, you know, for citizenship to,
sure.
to, you know, I think also when your guest mentioned that, like, during the 1918 flu epidemic, everybody kind of played along, was wearing masks. But even at that time, there were anti-mask leagues.
No question.
You know, San Francisco, one of the hardest hit places, was very much, you know, there were these different liberty groups that were like, nope, not me, I don't have to. And I think there is, you know, one of our, you know, a mindset that confuses being contrarian with their liberties, you know? And,
yeah, sure. Till, you know what? Let me take you've raised some really good points, and I'm really glad you called into the show, because especially because you're an ER nurse and you are living this. So that is an important perspective that you're bringing to the conversation.
Yeah.
Dominic, just to give you a chance to respond. He's right. We don't refuse care to people who are drug addicts, for instance.
Absolutely, and we should not. And so there's two points I would make there. One is that individuals who appear in the ER, they maybe have overdosed, they have an addiction, they're sick with a disease. We don't refuse their care. We don't think of the addiction as a moral choice, or I hope we don't. And we do provide them emergency care, and that's the right thing to do. Again, the article isn't to say you need to triage these people away. The article is a call to them to recognize their behavior is going to cause problems. So I would not want to see any of this in a triage guideline. Let's just, you know, get that on the
sure.
record. This is not
sure.
something that should be on a triage guideline. However, I would draw a different analogy to someone maybe who's on a transplant list and needs a liver and says, you know what, I'm not going to comply with any of the rules to get this liver. I'm not going to stop drinking. I'm not going to stop doing drugs. In fact, if you give me the liver, I'm not going to take the immunosuppressant drugs to make the liver work and to get the most value out of this liver. Would we give that person a liver? No, we wouldn't. In fact, transplant centers will refuse people who make those kind of crazy claims. And so that's, to me, a better analogy. It's, you know, we have a very scarce resource, and folks are undermining the way in which we're going to be able to ration these out equitably. They're almost like line cutters or something, but worse. They're making the situation of the line worse. It's almost like you're on a sinking ship and trying to figure out who gets on the lifeboats while people are drilling holes into the sinking ship, making it go down faster. Do you really want somebody who's drilling holes in a sinking ship on your lifeboat? You know, there's many levels to this, but at the end of the day, I think it turns, you know, on basic social responsibility and virtue. And you know, we have a lack of, you know, sort of a deeper sense of community and solidarity in our society that seems to really foment this kind of protest.
Till, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me correct myself. I talked about drug addicts, and I know that's an incorrect way, rather than saying someone who is addicted to drugs. Let me read a comment from Emily. Like motorcyclists without helmets and younger reckless drivers who are statistically risky, people who refuse to wear masks should pay increased insurance premiums. Here's a comment from Holly. This is a personally satisfying thought in my weaker moments. And though I find the spirit and substance of these protests repugnant, there is no conditionality on free speech. I feel that it should also put healthcare providers who swore an oath in an ethical bind when presented with these kinds of non-legally binding testaments when someone needs acute care. So she's taking your example. Let's say someone does sign one of these waivers, but they are brought to the hospital. Does the hospital abide by that waiver?
Only if it's been executed as an advance directive, like anything else. I mean, people can decline care for all sorts of reasons, using a living will or durable power of attorney. So if you add that to a legit advance directive, then yes. But otherwise, I wouldn't.
I wonder, too, when we, you know, every state, including Pennsylvania, beginning to open up bit by bit, does that just confuse the matter?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, it does. I mean, there's going to be sort of week by week changes in the risk benefit profile of every location. And so folks who see one part of the state turn green while theirs is still red have to understand that the dynamics of the epidemic are very different, depending on where you are, of course. And so, you know, I think it can be a little confusing, but if folks just get the right information and understand that, you know, that different places have different, you know, populations, different healthcare systems, et cetera, and that changes the profile of risk, that should make sense. But I don't know that people understand that because the information has been has been really distorted.
Here's the final email. This one from Daniel. We have the right to protest without punishment, but civil disobedience has consequences. You want to speak to that, Dominic?
I would argue you don't really have the right to spread disease. So if protesting spreads disease, I would say you don't really have the right to do that. But yeah, I mean, I think civil disobedience does come with consequences.
So did you get the kind of response to this op-ed that you were hoping for? Were there any surprises?
Many of the objections came in around, you know, somebody smokes, somebody's, you know, skiing and they get hurt. And right. A lot of arguments around, you know, risk-taking behavior in general, which, you know, again, this is really a fundamental point we were driving at, which is that the protests themselves are really a unique kind of attack or sabotage of our public health system. And that's why I would distinguish folks who are protesting from folks who are just taking a run without a mask or going to a bar. So that was the main objection we heard, which was, you know, you can, I think, easily respond to. But for the most part, it was supportive. I mean, you know, I think the folks that are going to these protests are like a very slim fraction of, you know, Americans. And most people understand the importance of, you know, social distancing, staying isolated if you've been exposed, the basics of public health. I think most people get it and agree and find these protests to be pretty abhorrent.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Dominic Sisti, thanks for joining us on Radio Times and driving around to find a good cell, right?
Thanks, Marty. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Appreciate that. He's an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to talk more about this issue with our guest, Allison Buttenheim, and she is waiting in the wings to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Mosk.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Owen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. This past Memorial Day weekend, as the country began to reopen, there were beaches and pools, bars and restaurants crowded with people who were not social distancing and not wearing protective face masks. There have been protests, as we were talking about, against lockdown policies, with participants claiming their rights are being violated and questioning the science and medical need for protecting themselves and others against coronavirus. We want to talk about why some people refuse to follow public health recommendations and if there are ways to change their behavior. And joining us is Allison Buttenheim. She's an associate professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing and associate director of Penn Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. Allison, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I wish I was in the studio with you.
Oh, well, so do I. I'm here home in my messy desk surrounded by all sorts of junk. But I do want to make sure our listeners can join our conversation, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You know, I think it just needs to be said, and I certainly feel it. I want to go outside. I want to be with my friends and my family. I want to see my grandkid. All those things are real. And I think with the warm weather and even the loosening of some of these rules and regulations, the desire to just sort of break free is so palpable and so strong. Do you feel that?
I absolutely do. I mean, you've just laid out a really good recipe for why it's so hard for people to stick with the mask wearing and the social distancing and the staying at home where possible. And it's been a long, you know, 8 or 10 weeks for most folks.
So if everything were still in place, do you think we wouldn't feel so antsy?
Well, what's nice about a stay-at-home order is it's really clear and simple, and you know right away whether you're following it or not. As things open up, the rules just get more complicated, and it puts lots more decisions on individuals day-to-day, hour-to-hour. Like, what am I supposed to do now? Is this okay? Is this okay? That's just gonna make for harder behavior change.
I mean, it seems that the medical personnel, whether doctors or nurses, have to deal with this issue of compliance all the time. I mean, that's really part of practice. And we really are talking about compliance, right?
Yeah, or adherence.
Adherence.
You know, with the medical professionals, it's just part of their practice. And, you know, that has changed under COVID-19. There's more strict rules for PPE. But, you know, they are prompted at their workplace. They are trained. They are reminded. I've heard a lot of physicians talk about how strict the nurses have been with them about, you know, going in and out of patient rooms. So they get a lot of reminders and a lot of support to do exactly what they're supposed to do. That's less true if you, you know, now kind of wander outside and head down to the supermarket to pick up some groceries. Those are, you know, no one's necessarily standing at the door handing you the mask.
What's, though, the psychology, I guess, behind whether non-compliance or non-adherence? I mean, is it just people don't understand? And this is a complicated and very worrisome pandemic that we're in. But help us understand what the thinking is when people think this does not apply to me.
Sure. I mean, a really interesting conversation with Dominic about, you know, people who are really actively refusing, you know, protesting against lockdowns or saying, I won't wear a mask. I think that's a small part of the population. Most of us, I think, probably want to do the right thing. But there's just a big gap between, you know, our intention or our preference and what we end up doing. And the COVID-19 situation is a really good example of why that gap is there, the gap between intention and behavior. And one thing is it's a new habit. You know, we're not used to doing this. We're not a country where mask wearing, for example, during flu season is common. And another, I think, really important kind of psychological aspect of this is most of us, at least a small majority of humans, tend to be what we call conditional cooperators. So we are, you know, we are eager and altruistic to contribute to the public good, but it's really important to us that other people are doing the same. So before we do something, we kind of look around and see, are other people doing it too? And if only, you know, just over half of the population does that, you can see how compliance or adherence would drop over time. And I see that now in my neighborhood. You know, people, as we've been going out a little bit more, people are asking each other, oh, were people wearing masks? Did you see people wearing masks? They aren't asking you so much, like, did you wear a mask or should I wear a mask? But what are other people doing? And until, you know, we regularly see most people wearing masks, we don't get that signal that that's what we're supposed to do.
My understanding is that most people either do wear masks or do believe that it's important to wear masks. But picking up on something you said earlier, are we giving, meaning the press, giving too much attention to people who break the rules, who protest, who go to swimming parties? And, you know, we saw those pictures over the weekend. Do they get too much attention? And then people begin to think, oh, maybe I don't need to wear a mask.
That's a great point. We actually, some of my colleagues and I just put together a tip sheet for governments on how to communicate policy and guidelines around COVID-19 response. And one of the points was don't publicize or emphasize the people who are violating the rules. Emphasize the fact that most people are following them, because that will, again, sort of trigger this conditional cooperation. So that's a great rule of thumb to follow.
So even just seeing pictures of people frolicking in a pool or by the beach, that's sort of enough to get people thinking, oh, yeah, maybe it's not so important to wear a mask.
Right, especially if you've been working. I mean, lockdown was hard, and that, you know, people put a lot of effort into that, and then you get sort of angry that, like, well, they're violating the rules. You know, what do I get? I want to do that too.
And I think we should also acknowledge that there is true suffering. I mean, we're talking about 20, maybe even more percent of the population that is not working and maybe lost their job temporarily or permanently. So the anxiety, the fear level is just astronomical.
That's right. And we are, I think Dominic mentioned this too, you know, we're getting conflicting information from the places we, you know, we want to be going for good information. So I still hear a lot of confusion about, you know, do masks work or why are we wearing them or does everybody have to wear them? And that makes decision making hard too, if we don't just get a crystal clear signal about what to do and why we're doing it.
Let me get a couple of callers in on our conversation. Looks like we've got Marie. She's on line two. Marie calling us into Radio Times. And go ahead. What's on your mind, Marie?
Hi. I just wanted to talk about Americans and societies and why people respond the way we do. You know, we were founded to be independent and have individual freedoms. That certainly has morphed into just being really selfish. If you look at other countries that are rule followers, so Germany, New Zealanders, Japanese, versus us, we tend to be more societal, like rule breakers and push the limits. And I feel like that's what's happening now. And I had hoped that when this happened, we would like all come together. But I guess we needed a voice from the top saying, hey, you know, America's really great. We are really independent. We have great things because of that. But let's all pull together and let's support each other and wear a mask and show each other that you honor one another because we're American. But that didn't happen. I think that's a piece of why we're in what we're in.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Marie. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Allison, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, mask wearing specifically got politicized. And that's just that's a recipe for, you know, lower adherence and moving away from a sort of medical epidemiological reason for doing something to a political statement, which is, I agree, really unfortunate.
Yeah. But do you think we are, compared to other countries, highly individualistic? And so we don't have that kind of collective feel for the society at large?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's been measured in really interesting sort of cross-country surveys that we tend to score higher on those sort of individualistic measures and a little bit lower on the sort of cooperative or community-oriented measures. And I think, yeah, I think we're seeing that as well.
Marie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get George Lakey to join our conversation. George, you're calling into Radio Times. Thanks for joining us. What do you have to say?
Hi, Marty. Good talking to you. So nice this to has to you. Do with a sociological perspective that adds one more layer to this and makes it kind of a perfect storm. And what we find in sociology is that polarization goes up and down in different decades. There have been times, some of us remember the 50s, a lot of consensus, a lot of unity, actually. Other decades, and increasingly in this decade, we've seen increasing polarization. What polarization does that has to do with this pandemic is it seizes upon any differences that might exist, and it's natural we have differences, sure, but it makes them way bigger than they would otherwise be, and therefore brings them to a level of irrationality that makes the people who are polarized unable to see any merit to the point of view of the others. And your earlier guest was saying, was puzzled, like, how would people take such a departure from common sense? But the characteristic of polarization is it makes everything so exaggerated that it appears that we've all in some way or other lost our minds, or at least the polls expressed in that way. And polarization, political scientists find, comes from economic inequality. And that's why in some decades we're way more unified. And in other decades, because of economic inequality, we're extremely polarized, because this is the most extreme economic inequality we've ever had in our history.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Allison Bettenheim says in response. Allison, go ahead.
I appreciate the sociological perspective. That's fantastic. I think another sort of implication of that, or follow-on from that, is what we observe as motivated reasoning or even information avoidance. So when we're this polarized, we will only sort of believe information or evidence from, you know, our camp. And there's really interesting experimental research that, you know, even the same facts presented to you as coming from, you know, your side versus the other side are evaluated differently. So, you know, it's hard enough to get sort of the evidence out there, but when people are selectively paying attention to the evidence from their camp, it's even harder to persuade people.
I'm thinking of past crises when, you know, presidents have essentially stood up to lead the country. And I think coming from President Trump, he is sending multiple mixed messages. We've done whole hours on it, but I'm just curious, as someone who looks at behavior and nudging behavior, how you see the role that he's played.
You know, lots of confusing messages. So, you know, not only not wearing a mask, but emphasizing why he doesn't have to or, you know, won't. Lots of information coming out of the White House that, you know, they're getting tested every day, his staff, whereas, you know, we have basically a testing crisis and shortage in the country. So that feels confusing. And then I think the other tension that's been hard for people to deal with is, you know, we're getting some guidance from the CDC and the White House about how states should open, mm-hmm. but states aren't necessarily following those. And then there's no sort of back and forth about why, you know, those gating criteria, for example, should be met. So if you're the resident of a state, you know, your governor says one thing, doesn't align with CDC, and then, you know, that state doesn't even follow what the governor originally said was going to happen. You feel like no one's in charge, and that's also really distressing.
Let me ask you about, I know you have worked with people who oppose vaccinations for their children. Are there things that you have learned from that we can apply to this pandemic?
Well, I think, again, some of this sort of conditional cooperation approach makes sense. And it's the same with childhood vaccination. We know the vast majority of parents vaccinate their kids on time and are happy to do that. We pay a lot more attention in the media and in research to the much smaller, much, much, much smaller group of parents who refuse or want to delay or space. And I think our communication, both in clinical practice when your physician's speaking to you and in public health campaigns, needs to emphasize that this is the normative behavior. What we do is that's what your neighbors are choosing to do, and that's what the other families in your kid's school are choosing to do. I think that applies here as well.
Yeah. I mean, which works better, the carrot or the stick?
Yeah. New York City had talked about fining people for violating, lockdown or stay-at-home orders, and lots of debate if that was a good strategy or not. A big stick there.
Is this for you, and I guess maybe for the nation, really, for all of us, this extraordinary opportunity to take a hard look at ourselves, to see what kind of people we are, what kind of country that we are?
It is. And, it's touching every part of the country. As a researcher, it's touching every discipline. George mentioned, sociology and political science, the epidemiology, the public health, the bench research that's happening. Really asking, everything from all of us in this massive response. And, I have kids at sort of important milestone ages, like an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old. And oh, wow. I know that they will look back on this as such a remarkable time to have passed through those sort of age milestones. It will mark that cohort for the rest of their lives.
Mark them in ways that can be growth enhancing and ways that can be disruptive.
Yep, very disruptive. I'll tell you, for my high school senior, it has not been a fun senior spring.
Are we going to make it through, Allison Buttenheim, out the other side?
We are absolutely going to make it through. We have great lessons from 1918, and we are resilient, and we are creative and innovative as a culture. That's maybe the upside of also being individualistic, and lots of good people proposing lots of good solutions that we can implement.
And vaccines, it seems like an effective vaccine is going to pull us through.
It will pull us through. It's not coming tomorrow. And we are already starting to think about research around promoting it, because I think in 1 or 2 years, we assume now everyone will rush to get it. But we will have vaccine refusal and hesitancy around the coronavirus vaccine as well.
Well, I really appreciate talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Allison Buttenheim, Associate Professor of Nursing and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She's also Associate Director of Penn Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. Appreciate all those calls and comments to Radio Times. You can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show wherever you do get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.